Chapter 27. Weird Shit on the M4. From The Extraordinary Career of George Formby by John Williams. George Formby was born George Hoy Booth in Wigan in 1904. He followed his father into the music hall business, adopted the ukulele as his trademark, and by the time the war broke out, he was a star of variety, pantomime and film. During the first years of the war, he and his wife Beryl toured extensively for ENSA, entertaining the troops as well as making a series of highly successful movies. When invasion of England was inevitable, most influential dignitaries and celebrities were shipped out to Canada. Moving underground with the English resistance and various stalwart regiments of the local defence volunteers, Formby manned the outlawed Wireless St. George and broadcast songs, jokes and messages to secret receivers across the country. The Formbys used their numerous contacts in the north to smuggle Allied airmen to neutral Wales and form resistance cells that harried the Nazi invaders. In post-war Republican England, he was made non-executive president for life. I avoided the news crews who were staking out the Spec Ops building and parked at the rear. Major Drab was waiting for me as I walked into the entrance lobby. He saluted smartly, but I detected a slight reticence about him this morning. I handed him another scrap of paper. "Good morning, Major. Today's assignment is the Museum of the American Novel in Salisbury."
"Very good. Agent next."
"Problems, Major?"
"Well," he said, biting his lip nervously, "yesterday you had me searching the library of a famous Belgian, and today the Museum of the American Novel. Shouldn't we be searching more, well, Danish facilities?"
I pulled him aside and lowered my voice. "That's precisely what they would be expecting us to do. These Danes are clever people. You wouldn't expect them to hide their books in somewhere as obvious as the Wessex Danish Library now, would you?" He smiled and tapped his nose.
"Very astute, Agent Next."
Drab saluted again, clicked his heels, and was gone. I smiled to myself and pressed the elevator call button. As long as Drab didn't report to Flanker, I could keep this going all week. Bowden was not alone. He was talking to the last person I would expect to see in a Literatech office, Spike.
"Yo, Thursday," Spike said.
"Yo, Spike." He wasn't smiling. I feared it might be something to do with Cindy, but I was wrong.
"Our friends in SO6 tell us there's some seriously weird shit going down on the M4, he announced. "And when someone says weird shit, they call
you.
Bingo. But the weird shit merchant can't do it on his own, so he calls
me.
Bingo."
There was another officer with them. He wore a dark suit, typical of the upper Spec Ops divisions, and he looked at his watch in an unsubtle manner. "Time is of the essence, Agent Stoker."
"What's the job?" I asked.
"Yes," returned Spike, whose somewhat laid-back attitude to life-and-death situations took a little getting used to.
"What is the job?"
The suited agent looked impassively at us both.
"Classified," he announced. "But I am authorized to tell you this. Unless we get Bleep back in under Bleep Bleep hours, then Bleep will seize ultimate executive Bleep, and you can Bleep goodbye to any semblance of Bleep."
"Sounds pretty bleepin' serious," said Spike, turning back to me. "Are you in?"
"I'm in." We were driven without explanation to the roundabout at Junction 16 of the M4 motorway. SO6 were national security, which made for some interesting conflicts of interest. The same department protecting Formby also protected Kane. And for the most part, the SO6 agents looking after Formby did so against Kane's SO6 operatives, who were more than keen to see him gone. Spec Ops factions always fought, but rarely from within the same department. Kane had a lot to answer for. In any case, I didn't like them, and neither did Spike. And whatever it was they wanted, it would have been pretty weird.
No one calls Spike until every avenue has been explored. He was the last line of defense before rationality started to crumble. We pulled onto the verge, where two large black Bentley limousines were waiting for us. Parked next to them were six standard police cars, with the occupants looking bored and waiting for orders. Something pretty big was going down.
"Who's she?" demanded a tall agent with a humorless demeanor as we stepped from the car.
"Thursday next," I replied. SO-27.
"Literary detectives," he sneered. "She's good enough for me," said Spike. "If I don't get my own people, you can do your own weird shit."
The SO-6 agent looked at the pair of us in turn.
"ID?"
I showed him my badge. He took it, looked at it for a moment, then passed it back. "My name is Colonel Parks," said the agent. "I'm head of presidential security. This is Dowding, my second in command." Spike and I exchanged looks. The president? This really was serious. Dowding, a laconic figure in a dark suit, nodded his greeting as Parks continued. "Firstly, I must point out to you both that this is a matter of great national importance, and I am asking for your advice only because we're desperate. We find ourselves in a head-of-state deficit condition by virtue of a happenstance of high otherworldliness possibility situation, and we hoped you might be able to reverse-engineer us out of it."
"Cut the waffle," said Spike. "What's going on?"
Parks's shoulders slumped, and he took off his dark glasses. "We've lost the president." My heart missed a beat. This was bad news. Really bad news. The way I saw it, the president wasn't due to die until next Monday, after Cain and Goliath had been neutered. Formby's going missing or dying early allowed Cain to gain power and start World War III a week before he was meant to, and that was certainly not in the game plan. Spike thought for a moment and then said,
"Bummer."
"Quite."
"Where?"
Parks swept his arm towards the busy traffic speeding past on the motorway.
"Somewhere out there."
"How long ago?"
12 hours.
Chancellor Cain has got wind of it, and he's pushing a parliamentary vote to establish himself dictator at 6 o'clock this evening. That gives us less than 8 hours.
Spike nodded thoughtfully.
"Show me where you last saw him."
Parks snapped his fingers, and a black Bentley drew up alongside. We climbed in, and the limo joined the M4 in a westerly direction, the police cars dropping in behind to create a rolling roadblock. Within a few miles, our lane of the busy thoroughfare was deserted and quiet. As we drove on, Parks explained what had happened. President Formby was being driven from London to Bath along the M4, and somewhere between junctions 16 and 17, where we now were, he vanished. The Bentley glided to a halt on the empty asphalt.
"The president's car was the center vehicle in a three-car motorcade," explained Parks as we got out. "Saunderby's car was behind. I was with Dowding in front, and Mallory was driving the president. At this precise point, I looked behind and noticed that Mallory was indicating to turn off. I saw them move onto the hard shoulder, and we pulled over immediately."
Spike sniffed the air.
"And then what happened?"
"We lost sight of the car. We thought it had gone over the embankment, but when we got there, nothing. Not a bramble out of place. The car just vanished."
We walked to the edge and looked down the slope.
The motorway was carried above the surrounding countryside on an earth embankment. There was a steep slope that led down about 15 feet through ragged vegetation to a fence. Beyond this was a field, a concrete bridge over a drainage ditch, and beyond that, about half a mile distant, a row of white houses.
"Nothing just vanishes," said Spike at last. "There is always a reason, usually a simple one, sometimes a weird one, but always a reason. Dowding, what's your story?"
"Pretty much the same. His car started to pull over, then just, well, vanished from sight."
"Vanished?"
"More like melted, really," said a confused Dowding.
Spike rubbed his chin thoughtfully and bent down to pick up a handful of roadside detritus, small granules of toughened glass, shards of metal and wires from the lining of a car tire. He shivered.
"What is it?" said Parks.
"I think President Formby's gone dead side."
"Then where's the body? In fact, where's the car?"
"There are three types of dead," said Spike, counting on his fingers. "Dead, undead, and semi-dead. Dead is what we call in the trade spiritually bereft. The life force is extinct. Those are the lucky ones. Undead are the spiritually challenged. That I seem to spend most of my time dealing with. Vampires, zombies, bogeys, and what have you."
"And the semi-dead?"
"Spiritually ambiguous. Those that are moving on from one state to another, or in a spiritual limbo. What you and I generally refer to as ghosts."
Parks laughed out loud, and Spike raised an eyebrow, the only outward sign of indignation I had ever seen him make.
"I didn't ask you along so I could listen to some garbage about ghoulies and ghosties and long-legged beasties, Officer Stoker."
"Don't forget things that go bump in the night," countered Spike. "You won't believe how bad a thing can bump if you don't deal with it quick."
"Whatever. As far as I can see, there is one state of dead, and that's not living. Now, do you have anything useful to add to this investigation or not?"
Spike didn't answer. He stared hard at Parks for a moment, and then scrambled down the embankment towards a dead and withered tree. It had leafless branches that looked incongruous amongst the summer greenery, and the plastic bags that had caught in its branches moved lazily in the breeze. Parks and I looked at one another, then slid down the bank to join him. We found Spike examining the short grass with great interest.
"If you have a theory, you should tell us," said Parks, leaning against the tree. "I'm getting a bit bored with all this New Age mumbo-jumbo."
"We all visit the realm of the semi-dead at some point," continued Spike, picking at the ground with his fingers like a chimp checking a partner for fleas. "But for most of us, it's only a millisecond as we pass from one realm to the next. Blink, and you'll miss it. But there are others. Others who loiter around in the world of the semi-dead for years. The spiritually ambiguous, who don't know they're dead. Or, in the case of the President, they're by accident."
"And?" asked Parks, who was becoming less keen on Spike with each second that passed. Spike carried on rummaging in the dirt. So the SO6 agent shrugged resignedly and started to walk back up the embankment.
"He didn't stop for a leak at Membry or Cheveley Services, did he?" announced Spike in a loud voice. "I wonder if he even went at Reading."
Parks stopped, and his attitude changed abruptly. He slid clumsily back down the embankment and rejoined us.
"How did you know that?"
Spike looked around at the empty fields.
"There is a motorway services here."
"There was going to be," I corrected. "But after Kingdon St... I mean, Lee Delamere was built, it wasn't considered necessary."
"It's here all right," replied Spike. "Just occluded from our view. This is what happened. The President needs a leak and tells Mallory to pull over at the next services. Mallory is tired and his mind is open to those things usually hidden from sight. He sees what he thinks are services and pulls over. For a fraction of a second, the two worlds touch. The presidential Bentley moves across, and then part again. I'm afraid, ladies and gentlemen, that President Formby has accidentally entered a gateway to the underworld, a living person adrift in the abode of the dead."
There was a deathly quiet.
"That is the most insanely moronic story I've ever been forced to listen to," announced Parks, not wanting to lose sight of reality for even one second. "If I listened to a gaggle of lunatics for a month, I'd not hear a crazier notion."
"There are more things in heaven and earth, Parks, than are dreamt of in your philosophy."
There was a pause as the SO6 agent weighed up the facts.
"Do you think we can get him back?" he asked at last.
"I fear not. The spirits of the semi-dead will be flocking to him like moths to a light, trying to feed off his life force and return themselves to the land of the living. Such a trip would almost certainly be suicidal."
Parks sighed audibly.
All right. How much? 10 grand. Realm of the Dead, certain to die, work pays extra.
Each? Since you mention it, why not?
Okay, then, said Parks with a faint grin. You'll get your blood money, but only on results.
Wouldn't have it any other way.
Spike beckoned me to follow him, and we climbed back over the fence, the SO6 agents staring at us, unsure of whether to be impressed or have us certified or what.
That really put the wind up 'em, hissed Spike,
as we scrambled to the top of the embankment, across bits of broken bumpers and shards of plastic moulding.
Nothing like a bit of woo-woo crossing over into the spirit world stuff to scare the crap out of 'em.
You mean you were making all that up? I asked, not without a certain degree of nervousness in my voice. I had been on 2 jobs with Spike before. On the first, I was nearly fanged by a vampire. On the second, almost eaten by zombies.
I wish, he replied. But if we make it look too easy, then they don't cough up the big moolah. It'll be a cinch. After all, what do we have to lose?
Our lives?
Da! You must loosen up a bit, Thursday. Look upon it as an experience, part of death's rich tapestry. You ready?
No.
Good. Let's hit them semi-deads where it hurts.
By the fifth time we had driven the circuit between junction 16 and 17, and without so much as a glimpse of anything other than bored motorists and a cow or two, I was beginning to wonder whether Spike really knew what he was doing.
Spike?
He replied, concentrating on the empty field that he thought might contain the gateway to the dead. What exactly are we looking for?
I don't have the foggiest idea. But if the President can make his way in without dying, so can we. Are you sure you won't put Biffo on mid-oop attack? He's wasted on defence. You could promote Jono to striker and use Jam and Snake to build up defence.
If I don't find another 5 players, it might not matter anyway, I replied. I managed to get Alf Widdershane out of retirement to coach, though. You used to play county croquet, didn't you?
No way, Thursday.
Oh, go on.
No.
There was a long pause. I stared out the window at the traffic, and Spike concentrated on driving, every now and then looking expectantly into the fields by the side of the road. I could see this was going to be a long day, so it seemed to be as good a time as any to broach the subject of Cindy. I wasn't keen to kill her, and Spike, I knew, would be less than happy to see her dead.
So,
when did you and Cindy tie the knot?
About 18 months ago.
Have you ever visited the Realm of the Dead?
Orpheus told me about the Greek version of it over coffee once, but only the highlights.
Does she, have a job?
She's a librarian, replied Spike. Part-time. I've been there a couple of times. It's not half as creepy as you'd have thought.
The library?
The abode of the dead. Orpheus would have paid the ferryman, but, you know, that's just a scam. You can easily do it yourself. Those inflatable boats from Walmart work a treat.
I tried to visualize Spike paddling his way to the underworld on a brightly colored inflatable boat, but quickly swept it aside.
So, which library does Cindy work in?
The one in High Close.
They have daycare, so it's very convenient.
I want to have another kid, but Cindy's not sure.
How's your husband, by the way? Still eradicated?
Wavering between to be and not to be at the moment.
So there's hope, then?
There's always hope.
My sentiments entirely.
Ever had a near-death experience?
Yes, I replied, recalling the time I was shot by a police marksman in an alternative future.
What was it like?
Dark.
That sounds like a plain old common or garden variety death experience, replied Spike cheerfully. I get them all the time.
No, we need something a bit better than that.
To pass over into the dark realm, we need to just come within spitting distance of the Grim Reaper, and over there, tantalizingly just out of his reach.
And how are we going to achieve that?
Haven't a clue.
He turned off the motorway at Junction 17 and took the entrance ramp back onto the opposite carriageway to do another circuit.
What did Cindy do before she was married? She was a librarian then, too. She comes from a long line of dedicated Sicilian librarians. Her brother is a librarian for the CIA.
The CIA?
Yes. He spends the time travelling the world, cataloguing their books, I presume.
It seemed as though Cindy was wanting to tell him what she really did, but couldn't pluck up the courage. The truth about Cindy might easily shock him, so I thought I'd better plant a few seeds of doubt. If he could figure it all out himself, it would be a great deal less painful.
"Does it pay well, being a librarian?"
"Certainly does," exclaimed Spike. "Sometimes she's called away to do freelance contract work, emergency card file indexing or something, and they pay her in used notes too, in suitcases. Don't know how they manage it, but they do."
I sighed and gave up. We drove around twice more. Parks and the rest of the SO6 spooks had long since got bored and driven off, and I was beginning to get a little tired of this myself.
"How long do we have to do this for?" I asked, as we drove onto the Junction 16 roundabout for the seventh time, the sky darkening and small spots of rain appearing on the windshield. Spike turned on the wipers, which squeaked in protest.
"Why, am I keeping you from something?"
"I promised Mum she wouldn't have to look after Friday past 5.
"What are grannies for? Anyway, you're working."
"Well, that's not the point, is it?" I answered. "If I annoy her, she may decide not to look after him again."
"She should be grateful for it. My parents love looking after Betty, although Cindy doesn't have any. They were both shot by police marksmen while being librarians."
"Doesn't that strike you as unusual?"
He shrugged. "In my line of work, it's difficult to know what unusual is."
"I know the feeling. Are you sure you don't want to play in the super hoop?"
"I'd sooner attempt root canal work on a werewolf."
He pressed his foot hard on the accelerator and weaved around the traffic that was waiting to return to the westbound M4.
"I'm bored with all this. Death, drape your sable coat upon us."
Spike's car shot forward and rapidly gathered speed down the slip road as a deluge of summer rain suddenly dumped onto the motorway, so heavy that even with the wipers on full speed it was difficult to see. Spike turned on the headlights, and we joined the motorway at breakneck speed through the spray of a passing juggernaut before pulling into the fast lane. I glanced at the speedometer. The needle was just touching 95.
"Don't you think you'd better slow down?" I yelled.
But Spike just grinned maniacally and overtook a car on the inside. We were going almost 100 when Spike pointed out the window and yelled,
"Look!"
I gazed out my window to the empty fields. There was nothing but a curtain of heavy rain falling from a leaden sky. As I stared, I suddenly glimpsed a sliver of light as faint as a will-o'-the-wisp. It might have been anything, but to Spike's well-practiced eye, it was just what we'd been looking for, a chink in the dark curtain that separates the living from the dead.
"Here we go!"
yelled Spike, and he pulled the wheel hard over. The side of the M4 greeted us in a flash, and I had just the barest glimpse of the embankment, the white branches of the dead tree and rain swirling in the headlights, before the wheels thumped hard on the drainage ditch and we left the road. There was a sudden smoothness as we were airborne, and I braced myself for the heavy landing. It didn't happen. A moment later, we were driving slowly into a motorway services in the dead of night. The rain had stopped, and the inky black sky had no stars. We had arrived.